According to the latest science, at least 1 in 10 people who get COVID-19 go on to develop long COVID. This from a scientific review just published in the journal Nature and carried out by a team at the Department of Immunology and Inflammation at the Imperial College London. And lest you think 1 in 10 isn't bad, here's what the study says. The oncoming burden of long COVID is so large as to be unfathomable. And an estimated 400 million people, up to 400 million people, will need help with it. Dr. Danny Altman is one of the authors of the Long COVID Review. He's a professor of immunology at Imperial College School of Medicine and co-author of a book that came out last year called The Long COVID Handbook. And he's with me now from London, I imagine. Are you there?
Yes, I am here. Hello.
Hello. In your book, I mean, how? What doesn't... Can I ask a question? What doesn't long COVID affect? In your book, you say there is no end of unusual stuff being reported by long haulers, people who suffer from long COVID, from the profoundly disabling to the merely upsetting. What, in 15 words, would you describe long COVID as? Sorry about the long question.
No, good question. Well, I'll try in about 15 words. So I think most people who've come across long COVID can by now picture that kind of core set of symptoms that have things like wheeze and breathlessness and fatigue and kind of, you know, post-exertional malaise and brain fog. Yeah, so there's a kind of core set that come near the top of the list. And then you have all the rest of the stuff that appears sort of variably in our cohorts. Word finding difficulties and insomnia and skin rashes and new allergies and, you know, about 200 other things that come and go sort of variably in our cohorts.
One of the things that you point out is organ damage. This is in the review of the science of the heart and the lungs. This is presumably because of inflammation. Why does it go on? Why is COVID long?
Yeah, no, well, you know, that's the heart of the matter, isn't it? So in our paper, we have a table where we try and describe all the hypotheses for what long COVID is. And one of the starting points was just, you know, to say the very obvious, wasn't it? To say that this is a very kind of insidious virus that gets into many tissues in the body. The aficionados will realize it's the tissues that have ACE2, the receptor for the virus. And so it can get into, you know, the heart and the lungs and the liver and, you know, the olfactory lobe, the part of the brain to do with smelling and tasting. And it can do damage there, the kind of things that you'd be able to see on an MRI. And I think that's part of the answer that we're looking at, but not the whole answer.
Could other viruses be doing those very things as well? It's just that we are studying COVID more.
Yeah, I mean, a good question, isn't it? Because, we've had to learn, haven't we, all of us, so much about viruses these last 3 years. And because this SARS-CoV-2 virus has zoomed to the top of our lists as the human viral infection that we know most about, there's a danger that we kind of get obsessed by it and think it's special and unique, and yet just don't have the data sets to be able to compare with the others. And yet, when we kind of go back and do our homework and say, well, maybe, you know, were other things, was flu the same all along? Were other things the same all along? The answer is not really. I think it's particularly nasty and a little bit unusual.
Is there any correlation between vaccinated or not vaccinated and long COVID?
Yeah, so there definitely is some protection through being vaccinated. So what do I mean by that? I mean, well, let's just take that stepwise. The best way to not get long COVID is not to get COVID, and the best way to not get COVID is to be well vaccinated and boosted and have a good level of antibodies to stop the virus getting in. So that's the first thing to say. And yet we know perfectly well that there are many people who were vaccinated who did get breakthrough infections, and some of those have gone on to get long COVID. But we know that in those breakthrough cases in the vaccinated people, your chance of long COVID is further reduced, perhaps by another 50%. So vaccination doesn't get you off the hook completely, but it certainly helps your odds.
You know that there are people who say that it's the vaccinations that cause the long COVID. It's the vaccinations that make things worse. Do you have to answer that very often? Because I've got people texting me right now saying such things.
Okay, again, let me try and sort of answer that as clearly and honestly as I possibly can. My overall interpretation of the data, and I spend an awful lot of my life looking at data in enormous detail in enormous numbers, is what I just said. Yeah, that the vaccinations have been amazing and miraculous, and have worked terribly well, and have got the planet out of a terrible fix. Otherwise, who knows where we'd be now in terms of our, mortality and our misery and our economies. So they worked very well. And I, like you've had, have had a lot of people, always have a steady trail of people saying, don't you know it's the vaccines that actually did the harm and caused the long COVID? So I'd answer that in two different ways. The first thing is to point people in the direction of the evidence I've just talked about, that the big data all says that vaccines prevent COVID and further prevent long COVID. So I've got no doubt in my mind about that. And yet, this is a complex business with on an enormous scale across the planet. And some people have come to me with, quite a good narrative that says, I was healthy, I had the vaccine, and immediately afterwards I had symptoms that looked like long COVID, and I think they were caused by the vaccine. And I think in some cases, I've got no reason to doubt them. That may very well happen sometimes to some people. So I don't need to take a hard line view of it. I accept that sometimes those people are telling it as it is.
All right, if you had long COVID right now, somebody is asking, what would you treat yourself with?
Simple answer is that I'd kind of be terrified to treat myself with anything because I think the question itself and the way it's been put to you is very telling, isn't it? Because we don't normally go in for do-it-yourself medicine, and I think it speaks to how many long COVID sufferers there are and how absolutely desperate they are and how impatient they've become. That medicine is being kind of served out on, social media platforms of people saying, "Have you tried this and have you tried that?" And people, I think, are doing some quite scary things. So you mentioned that long COVID handbook that I wrote with Jez Medinger, and the nature of our relationship in that book is, I think it was the Times described us as the odd couple, because he's the kind of crazy wacko patient who will do anything to himself to try and get better, sometimes landing himself in hospital quite ill in the process.
One should say he did have long COVID
Yeah, he does. He
and
does. He
does
does
still.
now. Does very much have long COVID, and and I'm not sort of belittling or making it sounds like I'm making fun of him, but I'm really really not. But he really was the full on activist patient trying things on himself. So I was forced to adopt the role of Professor Boring, putting himself in his place, putting him in his place, and saying, why on earth are you doing that? What for? So the long way of answering your question, that if what I would be doing now is going to see my doctor and being quite a difficult, demanding patient,
Nah.
and
No, you see,
and
I mean,
trying to get prepared.
that is why there are so many support groups, right? That is
Yeah.
why people are clustering because they believe that the medical profession is skeptical of them And you've experienced, as you say in the long handbook, you've experienced skepticism of your colleagues who say, why can't you just, you know, study something else for heaven's sake?
Yeah, get a life and move on. Yeah.
So going to your doctor is not necessarily helpful.
But I mean, you know, how do we practice modern medicine? I think it's all we've got, isn't it? You know, if your doctor isn't helpful, I don't know, change doctors, educate them, you know, take in the papers to show them. But we simply are in a very difficult and slightly desperate position at the moment, where I certainly experience it that a lot of long COVID patients around the world feel that there's almost a kind of conspiracy in the medical profession who know the treatments and are for some sort of cussed reason withholding the treatments. And the answer is that we've done an awful lot of work, but we don't really know even the full list of which drugs we'd put into a clinical trial tomorrow, given the chance. So we just need a little bit more work and a little bit more time, which isn't a very satisfying or pleasing answer.
More research on viral persistence is desperately needed, you say in the book. And in the review that you co-authored, you talk about viral reservoirs that coronavirus can remain in the body after the acute phase, and thus you get the ongoing disease. Can you see that?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Can you test for that?
Not quite. So I'm pleased you've brought that one up. So, you know, so of all the hypotheses around, and they don't need to be mutually exclusive, you know, that could be true, and the organ damage could be true, and the autoimmunity could be true, you know, and the blood clotting abnormalities, you know, all of these things could be part of it or could be in some people. But I like the one that you brought up, the viral persistence or the viral reservoirs, because if you think about it in terms of potential treatments, that's kind of low-hanging fruit, isn't it? Because if we were really good at identifying the people who've got a problem because they can't clear the virus and have a persistent reservoir, surely we could just come in with the appropriate antivirals or the appropriate monoclonal antibodies and make them better. Yeah, so, you know, easy to say, but even that's slightly hard to do because, the nature of your question, you know, how can I be certain who those people are and how to spot them? You'd imagine that maybe you could just, you know, get a poo sample and do a PCR on that, but that doesn't really tie up completely, so that isn't quite right. The gold standard, it was kind of worked up in people who were in clinics, things like their irritable bowel disease or their Crohn's disease, you know, so the kind of people who are having gut biopsies as part of their treatment anyway, and looking in the gut biopsies and realizing there was virus lurking in there. So that's where the kind of, you know, gold standard answer comes from. But we don't, it wouldn't be ethical to go around taking out bits of people's guts to have a look. So we need to think of kind of snazzy ways to test that and spot who those people are. And that would be a very good place to start treating people.
People who suffer from ME or chronic fatigue syndrome,
yes,
have made common cause with people suffering from long COVID and vice versa. How similar are those conditions, do you think?
I think they're terribly similar, and I think it's really sort of helpful and illuminating to join up those discussions. Yeah, almost every time I go on sort of TV or radio, I get a certain amount of comment from people in the ME/CFS community, really quite angry with me and saying, "Well, you know, you've jumped on the bandwagon now, but where have you been the last 20 years? Nobody's heard us, nobody's listened to us, nobody's researched on us." And my answer is always the same. It's, well, first of all, just, you know, an apology on the part of the medical community, because, yeah, nobody was prepared to fund that research. Nobody was that interested. Nobody had the wherewithal to look at it. And now I think we're at a kind of, you know, Rosetta Stone moment where understanding one can illuminate the other in a kind of bidirectional way. Because so many things that were discussed over the years in ME/CFS are almost certainly relevant for long COVID and vice versa. So some of the blood biomarkers that we talk about are the same in both of them. some of the gut microbiome changes that we talk about are the same in both of them, and the symptom list is massively overlapping.
What do you think would be the breakthrough on long COVID? Just a diagnostic test would be a huge start, wouldn't it?
I think it really would be. So we're working really, really hard on that, and so are some other groups. And as you say, that would help in so many ways, wouldn't it? Both for recognition for those patients, for proper coding of those patients in their electronic healthcare records, and access to the correct clinical care pathways. It also means, that if we can count them and code them, then we can make proper sort of healthcare budgeting provision for them. And all the stuff we've been talking about, if we stop kind of dismissing it as self-reported and it's test reported, then we can actually get them into the right clinical trials and actually test out some of our ideas.
One of the things
So
that
it's critical.
people have raised in their communications with me this morning is what is called post, feeling exhausted after exercise. There's an expression for it. PEM, what is that?
Post-exertional malaise, it sounds
Yeah.
like to me.
And that's not
Yeah,
just
yeah.
feeling knackered after you've done too much. It's a thing, is it?
It's so yeah. So it's a kind of common theme here is unless you've either had long COVID or mix a lot with people who have long COVID, I think you can't appreciate the scale of the thing they're talking about. Sometimes if I speak to skeptical colleagues, they say, well, we're none of us getting any younger and I don't go up and down stairs as fast as I used to, or I don't ride my bike as much as I used to and things like that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about previously young, fit, healthy people who do, exert themselves, for 5 or 10 minutes, do something they shouldn't have done and have to kind of rest up for the rest of the weekend because they're absolutely shattered. They feel like they've run a marathon. And there's some studies around suggesting that that's to do with kind of impaired gas exchange, impaired uptake of oxygen across the lungs. It's not clear yet, but this is the real thing. This is really people absolutely shattered.
One of the fatigue symptoms is generalized fatigue, not necessarily post-exercise. And I've spoken to people who suffer from MS, for example, and they talk about MS fatigue. It's a particular kind of fatigue that they can clearly identify as that. There is an autoimmune angle on long COVID, similar in some way.
I wouldn't want to kind of alarm people by trying to be too literal in drawing connections between
No.
multiple sclerosis and long COVID. But I'm an immunologist, and I spent a lot of my life studying autoimmunity. So for people who aren't sort of up on the minutiae, autoimmunity obviously means that the immune system, which is evolved to attack things that shouldn't be in your body, things like bacteria and viruses and cancers, has got kind of misprogrammed or misdirected, and has started attacking proteins on your own cells, and that's central to the way that we think about multiple sclerosis. We and other people have tried hard to understand how big a part that plays in long COVID. And for the moment, it's still complex. So, what I mean by that is, yes, when we and other people look at the blood of people with long COVID, we find lots of different autoimmune patterns in terms of the autoantibodies that they have in their blood. I'd be lying if I said that I was confident at this point in how to kind of tie that in with their particular symptoms and explain what it's doing in the disease. We're still trying to sort that one out.
People are very certain about some things, aren't they? Don't you find? I've just heard from a naturopath who says the answer to catching COVID or developing long COVID is taking 10 to 20,000 IU daily of vitamin D3 with K2 plus zinc, vitamin C, and something else that I've lost now. Specific herbs, that's right. Unmentioned specific herbs. What do you think of those kind of prescriptions? Because alongside these support groups and the, you know, understandable ignorance of the medical profession, are an awful lot of people around the fringes claiming to have the answer.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think I'm going to come across a little bit Professor Boring again, yeah? So at the risk of being boring, yeah, I think, let me try and put it like this. So long COVID is really enormous and causing real global misery. And there are, you know, as we try and explain in this piece in Nature, there are some, you know, big underlying themes in terms of what we think the mechanisms are. There are so many schools of thought out there, some of them from conventional medicine, some of them more fringe, like the example you just gave. And my job, I felt, in writing that review was to try and stand back from it all and take a really long, hard look at the hard data and the hard evidence and the hard numbers and try and put together a kind of consensus that I thought would be useful to build a kind of core agenda moving forward that would be useful to people. So I guess in the end, you know, not wanting to kind of poo-poo anybody, any hypothesis or be nasty to anyone, I just feel like the way that in the end, I suppose it's happened a lot after COVID that, you know, we've all got so angry and so polarized and so siloed and sort of gone off into our little corners to kind of shout at people. I feel like that's not helpful for making people better.
Yes, and this is what you say in your book, The Long COVID Handbook, that we have become highly politically polarized by the pandemic, and added COVID libertarian versus COVID authoritarian views onto those divisions. And that's not helpful. And this is the tone of a lot of the communications I'm getting. The range of symptoms, the diversity of symptoms of long COVID are such that it's almost impossible to think that one, you know, one drug or one antiviral might be the answer.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, when I talk about different hypotheses about the mechanism and how they're not mutually exclusive, it makes the trials very hard, doesn't it? Because I do think that when we get our act together, which I really, really hope we will do before too long, there may be some of those people who are really being helped by antivirals, and some of those people who are really being helped by anticoagulation treatment, and some who are really being helped by specific immunosuppression to help their autoimmunity. But you can imagine that if we take all of those different people and kind of stick them in the same pot and try and treat them the same, we might never disentangle the answers at all, and, you know, and might not help them very well. So we just need to do it carefully and logically.
Somebody says tinnitus is a long COVID thing. Any sign of that in your review?
I can't remember how much we talk about it, but we run a long COVID recruitment at our hospital, which I've called WILCO, where WILCO stands for working out the immunology of long COVID. And a lot of the people who come to us in that study have tinnitus and complain of tinnitus. And there's lots of ways that you could explain that. You know, it could be either, you know, damage to the nervous system by the virus, inflammation in the nervous system by the virus, or autoimmunity. So we just need to kind of, you know, do the work and sort it out.
Does whether you, I don't know whether you've covered this already, but does whether you develop long COVID depend on the severity of the initial COVID bout that you suffered from?
Yeah, super question. I mean, you don't, if it was logical, you'd imagine, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So how to answer that? So one of the studies we're involved with is called FOSP COVID, where FOSP stands for post-hospitalized, which means that it's really devoted to those first wave people who were sick enough to get ambulanced to hospital, and many of them were in intensive care, you know, so they were really severe end of COVID. So in those, there's an awful lot of long COVID, and it's quite severe long COVID, and that's maybe about 50% of that population. Okay, so that makes you feel that there's some kind of link to how severe your first attack was. And yet, confusingly, within our long COVID cohort that we're running, we've got plenty of people whose initial COVID was incredibly mild, bordering on asymptomatic. Anything goes really.
That's so weird, isn't it? I mean, if you
Yeah,
suffer
yeah,
from
yeah.
a mild illness that is barely reportable, but it leads on to something as severe as long COVID, how could that?
Well, so yeah. Well, what that so I don't the way I feel, the way I interpret that is that it's not simply to do with the amount of virus you have on board. It's to do with all the other sort of subsequent events that were triggered by that virus in terms of your immune response and things. But this is a virus or a virus family that does crazy, crazy things. So everything that we're describing here with COVID is almost identical to what was described in 2003, 2004 with SARS-1, which obviously is a very kind of close cousin of it, and did all the same things to those people, both in China and they had that big outbreak, didn't they, in Toronto. We have lived through this before. And
Somebody asks, what does the science say about the risks of repeat COVID infections?
so there's some publications and some data sets. So partly it's kind of the obvious in what we said before that if pardon me, if you've got immunity on board, whether from vaccine or infection or a combination of two hybrid immunity, you've got a somewhat reduced chance of getting infected and a somewhat reduced chance thereafter of getting long COVID. And yet, our cohorts are full of people who've got reinfected and, second or third or fourth time round got their long COVID. So, there's never any window for complacency, yeah, because it can always get you.
Have any explanation, asking for a friend, why some people have never had COVID?
Well, yeah, no, I'm not lots of so where do you start? I mean, so one reason for not having COVID is obviously is that some people were just very worried and shielded really well and really effectively and used their ventilation and their mask really well. Then there's I'm wondering if the question refers to a really nice paper that came out Wednesday night in Nature from a laboratory in San Francisco from Jill Hollenbach that analyzed the immune response genes of a very large cohort of people in the USA and said that there are people who have a particular immune response gene. It's called HLA-B15, and those people are especially good at generating immune memory from their previous exposure to common cold viruses, and they either don't get infected or get an asymptomatic infection and are really protected. So there's sort of fun things out there like that that give us kind of clues about what's going on.
Have you had COVID?
I have, yes.
Once.
I had it once at the beginning of the Omicron wave, my we have we I work with my wife on COVID, and we both run the team together. And she locked me in my study until I was PCR negative, and but I was I was fairly okay with it.
She provided you with some food and water, I take it.
There was really good catering. It was really okay. And
Good.
I worked in my study, and I lived to tell the tale.
Raises the question of, does it matter? Is there any indication that the strain of the coronavirus that you were infected with is more or less inclined to give you long COVID?
So we certainly know that really extensively that they can all do it. We and others have done research on, would your profile of long COVID and your symptom list look different depending on whether you were an Alpha or a Delta or an Omicron or an XBB person? And there's some nuances there, but they're fundamentally similar. And the key point that I always make about this, if sitting here as I do in the UK, it feels really stark to me that since we had our Freedom Day, and sort of unleashed all all got rid of all protection. We went almost straight into the Omicron wave and then the Omicron subvariants. And in a population with a so-called mild variant circulating and a population who was double or triple vaccinated, we've acquired an extra 700,000 people into our long COVID burden, it just from that period after Omicron. So because Omicron was so pervasive and so transmissible and so infectious, it's added absolutely massively to our long COVID burden at a time when, we weren't even counting or caring, which seems very cruel to me.
It's a question. I don't know. I don't know whether it's a valid question. I think it is. You talk about in your review of the immunology of long COVID and the science, you talk about, for example, brain and nervous system damage. There is a measurable amount of brain damage in people with COVID-19 and long COVID that was not there before they contracted SARS-CoV-2. How do you know?
How do we know?
How do you know it wasn't there before? Because before they got COVID, they wouldn't have been studied.
Yeah, not my work. It's sort of work of other people. So
Well,
one of
whatever.
the,
How
no,
did they
sure. So,
know?
yeah, right. Super. Okay, good question. So one of the most brilliant studies we talk about in the piece that came out last week comes from UK Biobank. So many people know UK Biobank. It's one of the most famous cohort studies in the world. So an enormous amount of resource was put all 12 or 13 years ago now behind a study led initially out of the University of Oxford, and it's now across the whole of the United Kingdom. And it recruited a large number of over 50s into the biobank, and they had to agree to be tracked over the years absolutely massively at the level of medical questionnaires and medical exams and MRIs and every possible test just to build up a story of what is normal, what is abnormal, what are the predictors of people who are going to die young, die old, have a heart attack, whatever it is. So because UK Biobank had this terrific longitudinal sweep, they had many people in their cohort just by chance who went on to develop COVID. And so they had their brain imaging, their MRI from before their COVID. They had their brain imaging, their MRI from after their COVID. And they also had lots of cognitive tests done before and after. And that's where some of the most scary answers come from, because some parts of their brain had shrunk as a consequence of the COVID. And their scores on cognitive tests had also come down as a consequence of the COVID. So I'm sorry to be so scary, but that's how we know.
That is a bit scary. And
Yeah.
is there any indication from your reading that that's a permanent change?
Hard, really. Yeah, no, nothing to say or know yet. In the context of long COVID, perhaps the only thing I'd add is that one of the questions I've been asked a lot throughout is, how long is this for, and when will I get better? And sure, we know in all of the long COVID groups that some people do get better, and things do improve, and the people who couldn't ride their bicycle have now started riding their bicycle, and some things for some people get better, and yet a lot of it is very stubbornly the same and doesn't get better very fast. And I tried to do a bit of crystal ball gazing by speaking to the consultants who treated those SARS-1 patients in 2003, 2004. And said, just tell me what happened to your patients. How long did it take them to get better? And one of them, John Patkai, the consultant who looked after the Toronto patients, wrote an article for me that was one of the most devastating things I'd read on the subject. I think it ended with the words, "In conclusion, none of my patients ever fully recovered. Most of them never went back to full-time employment. Many of them never got their old jobs back." So there's, it doesn't sound to me like a thing that goes away fast.
No, and certainly from what I'm hearing, a lot of people are still suffering, and they feel, as one person has put it, as if they're just regarded as collateral damage.
You don't want to go around in a state of permanent outrage, do you? But yes, I do feel outraged for them, of course.
You are continuing your research. What particular
As it were.
areas are you looking at now?
Well, for all the reasons we've discussed and all the stuff you just said, we kind of feel like we're in a race. Normally, as a scientist, it's very academic, isn't it? And it's about kind of getting another publication for your CV and getting the next grant. And we feel that this isn't like that. This is really about kind of a race to the finishing line to get some drugs into clinical trials that could actually make some people better. Because as immunologists, we feel that we've got quite a good kind of box of goodies to offer people. So if you think about immunology and modern medicine, lots of things have benefited enormously from that kind of research. If you think about cancer immunotherapy or treatment for autoimmune diseases like arthritis or multiple sclerosis, that's all come from really super immunology research. So I think we feel that if we could only sort of nudge this stuff over the line, we could maybe make a difference for people.
Are you worried that a new variant will come along and just kick us down the track?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the same thing, isn't it? Yes, of course, I do worry. It goes back to our discussion about the polarization. So everybody's either described now as a minimizer or a maximizer, and
Yes.
people are often describing me as a maximizer, and why doesn't he get a life and stop worrying about things under the bed? But viruses mutate, and trillions of copies of this virus are sitting in millions of lungs all over the world, and some of those are in immunosuppressed people who will have chronic infections that will kind of sit there quietly in their lungs mutating, which is how we got Omicron in the first place. And there's absolutely no rule that says that that isn't happening now. So yes, there are other worse variants percolating out there, and I don't see how we can kind of prevent that by wishful thinking.
I should ask you, and I imagine that there's no confidential information involved, given that your co-author of the Long COVID Handbook, Gez Meddinger, has been upfront about his condition.
Yeah.
How is he?
So I mean, you should have him on sometime, and he's probably better value for money than I am. But the answer is he's somewhat better. But obviously, I didn't know him before his long COVID. But he describes himself as having been, one of those really committed marathon runners who goes from marathon to marathon and things like that. And now he's still a person. So I saw him a few weeks back when we spoke at the same book festival together. He's a person who, if he's in action, doing a sound check or something for 5 or 10 minutes, will go and sit quietly in the corner and have a rest, and get his energy back together to do his next bit. So he's far from back to normal, nearly 3 years down the line.
I wish him well and thank you for your time. I presume you're going to be doing an update to the Long COVID Handbook as soon as anything deserves to be updated.
Absolutely. Yes.
As soon as you make that big breakthrough.
Well, we or anybody else, yeah.
Yeah, Professor Danny Altman, who's an immunologist at Imperial College London.